It's now my pleasure to introduce the Deputy Governor, Andrew Houser. He, of course, joined the Reserve Bank in February, coming over from the UK, where he held a variety of senior positions at the Bank of England. Most recently, he was the Executive Director for Markets. He was also the Executive Director for Banking, Payments and Financial Resilience. He oversaw the Bank of England's quarterly inflation report, its regional agency network, its international economic analysis, and he served on the secretariats of the Monetary and Financial Policy Committees. He was also Chief of Staff to the Governor in the aftermath of the GFC and alternate Executive Director at the IMF in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Andrew. I'll be back to moderate questions, so please get your questions ready as he's speaking.
There we go. Thank you, Bessa. It's a pleasure to be here. It's not all going to be jokes, I assure you. Tonight, actually, I'm going to talk about trade. So it's fitting that we're meeting on George Street, which I'm told runs along an ancient trading route between farmland to the south and the fresh fish and water in the harbour here. And in that context, let me join Bessa in acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation as the traditional owners and custodians of this land and pay my respects to elders past and present. Now, this is my first festive season in the Southern Hemisphere, and while there have been many reminders of this year of why being asked to move from the UK to Australia was such a privilege, few beat the prospect of seeing in the new year in temperatures of 25 to 30 degrees centigrade, while my former colleagues at the Bank of England scrape frost off their windscreens and thaw their frozen pipes. But the picture in terms of sunshine is starker still. Now, for those of you who are economists in the room, and I assume that kind of is all of you, I plotted here the average hours of sunshine per day through the year in Sydney in orange and in London down the bottom there. And while Sydney rejoices in an average of 6 to 8 hours a day all year round, at least according to this chart, Bessa thought it was more, London manages that only for a short period each summer, and most of the year it's much grayer. In fact, right now, down the bottom there, it barely gets light at all, and that, candidly, and those of you who've been in London know, is true. Now, it was this cold, dark British version of the festive season, not the sun-drenched Australian equivalent, that Charles Dickens described in A Christmas Carol. And as many of you may recall, in one of the more dramatic scenes of the book, the ghost of Christmas yet to come shows Scrooge a nightmarish vision of his own future, in which he dies alone and unloved, without friends or family, his possessions stolen and sold for scrap. Now, some people worry that the world economy could face a similar fate in 2025 if the US triggers a tit-for-tat trade war with China and other countries. And in that hypothetical scenario, the fear goes, economic activity would fall, prices would rise across the world, including here in Australia, as global supply chains are disrupted, weakening competition, productivity, and innovation. Of course, you can't rule such a nightmare scenario out completely. Australia is intimately linked to the world economic and financial system, and history shows that when trade, labor, and money flow freely in the global economy, we thrive, but when countries turn inwards, we suffer. But just as Scrooge didn't in fact meet his seemingly inevitable fate in the book, the macroeconomic implications for Australia from future global trade policies may also be less obvious than they first appear for three reasons. Firstly, we just don't know very much so far about the scale, scope, and timing of tariffs. Secondly, the impact on Australian economic activity is uncertain. We're not a major exporter to the US, so the direct impact of any tariffs could be limited. We have strong comparative advantages in raw materials and services that other countries need, both to power traditional industries and the industries of the future. We have a track record of nimbly reshaping our trading relationships through a combination of market forces and proactive policy, and our flexible inflation target and exchange rate can help absorb the impact of global shocks. Third, the implications for Australian inflation, and hence for monetary policy, could be plus or minus, depending on how tariffs affect the balance between supply and demand. I want to use the rest of my remarks this evening to elaborate on these points, and in doing so, I'm explicitly not going to cover the many other potential risks and opportunities in the world economy in the year ahead. Now, while researching this speech, it became clear to me that to understand the importance of trade for Australia, you could do a lot worse than look at the history of the very address we're meeting at tonight, 199 George Street. The first substantial structure on this site, the George Street Jail, was funded, and wait for it, by tariffs on spirits, wine, and beer. In the mid-1800s, the area was part of Little Canton, where the Chinese community lived and worked. And from the early 20th century, the Andronicus brothers sold imported coffee and chocolate here, first to walk-in customers, and some of you may be old enough to have been to the shop, and later, when the construction of the Sydney Harbour Bridge poleaxed their business, to the wholesale trade. In 1982, as part of the economy's long swing towards services, the building we sit in today opened as the Regent Hotel, described at the time as Sydney's first modern luxury hotel. And a year later, a glittering ceremony led by Bob Hawke launched the Business Council of Australia, Stephen. Its purpose not, in the words of its first president, Sir R.V. Parbow, to whinge to the government about narrow interests, but to develop long-term views in the broad national interests. Shortly before Christmas that same year, the government floated the exchange rate, liberalised Australia's capital account, and ushered in an era of wider economic reform that, of course, set the country on the road to prosperity. That's a table and a half, isn't it? I said about that. If those are the ghosts of Christmas past, fast forward to Christmas present, and the effects of that era of reform are clear. Our two-way trade equates to nearly 50% of GDP, a bit lower than other small open economies like South Korea or Sweden, but much higher than the US. We're a world leader in some markets, including iron ore. We attract some of the best educated overseas workers. Our institutional and business environment ranks in the top echelon, according to the IMD World Competitiveness Yearbook. And while the banks are relatively domestically focused, the super funds increasingly invest in overseas assets. Half our Commonwealth government debt is held by foreigners, and key financial variables move closely with global developments. So what does the future hold? Let's start with the positive. The direct impact of any US tariffs on Australia is likely to be limited. And that's because our sales to the US are relatively modest, accounting for just 5% of goods exports. Indeed, unlike many trading nations, we run a substantial trade deficit with the US, and perhaps I at least was surprised to find one of the largest of any country in the world. It's too soon to say what the scale and scope of any tariffs might be. We've got a free trade agreement, obviously, with the US, and have successfully negotiated exemptions in 2018. But if blanket tariffs are imposed, the value of our exports that are directly exposed as a share of GDP is amongst the smallest of any developed country. And quite amusingly, many of you won't even be able to see that Australia is right down the bottom there in red. And if Deutsche Bank is in the room, thank you very much for the idea for this chart. No woos, so I assume they're not. So far, so good. Well, not really, of course, because it's only the start of the story. US tariffs would depress demand in the US and other affected countries and may provoke retaliatory tariffs against the US and elsewhere. And the most extreme endgame of such a scenario, an all-out global trade war, would depress world activity and trade everywhere. And when seeking a historical analogy for such an outcome, people often reach for the Great Depression. The Depression didn't begin with a trade war, of course. The tariffs imposed by the Smoot-Hawley Act and the retaliation that followed made it much deeper and longer lasting than it otherwise would have been. Global activity fell by 15%, global trade by two-thirds, and that hit Australia hard, causing real GDP to fall by 10% and the unemployment rate to rise to 20%, leaving gaping economic and political scars. But the Depression's a poor analogy for the possible outlook we face today for several reasons. Perhaps the most important is the fundamental difference in macroeconomic policy frameworks. The contraction in activity in the 30s was substantially amplified, as you all know, by the primacy given to maintaining fixed exchange rates and the belief that that was the best way to deliver price stability. But adherence to fixed exchange rate pegs delayed the devaluation that countries like Australia needed to re-establish external balance, and it required restrictive monetary conditions when domestic demand needed the reverse. Today's policy framework is much less likely to amplify the effects of a global downturn. The exchange rate floats freely and monetary policy is focused on inflation and full employment, providing a powerful first line of defence against global developments. Indeed, it's a new RBA research discussion paper published today by Patrick Hendy and Benjamin Becker shows global shocks explain only about a fifth of the variability in domestic prices and activity. That's on the right-hand side there. And that's because changes in the exchange rate and the cash rate absorb the lion's share of those shocks. Now, a familiar illustration of that point comes from the global financial crisis and the parallel mining boom. Following the onset of the GFC, the flexible exchange rate regime allowed the RBA to cut interest rates rapidly, and that, together with fiscal stimulus, stable banking system, helped underpin domestic demand in a way that certainly was not true in my own country, the UK. Australian activity was also supported by strong growth, of course, in China, which had begun with its accession to the World Trade Organization in 2003, given further momentum by its 4 trillion yuan stimulus package in late 08. The huge increase in Chinese infrastructure, real estate construction led to a boom in steel production, which in turn gave a huge boost to demand for Australian commodities, most notably iron ore. And as I don't need to tell you in this room, the mining boom that followed transformed the Australian economy, lifting the terms of trade, drawing in massive investment flows, and solidifying China as Australia's number one trading partner. The shock absorbers were again in action during that period. In particular, the progressive appreciation of the Australian dollar helped the economy to adjust to the increase in national income and demand without threatening the inflation target. So our limited direct exposure to US tariffs, our flexible policy framework, should provide some insulation. But that's obviously not the end of the story either, because higher tariffs in the US and potentially elsewhere will also have an indirect effect on Australian demand by depressing activity right across global supply chains, many of which involve Australian firms. Now, there's some good news on that front too. Australia's participation in global value chains, meaning trading goods across borders two or more times between origination and final consumption, is lower than in many countries. Our global value chain related activity accounted for only 11% of total output in 2022, compared with 26% on average amongst other high and middle income countries. But within this average, our exposure is of course unusually concentrated. And I think this chart brings that point out really quite vividly, produced by the Bank for International Settlements, and some of you may have seen it. For each country, the x-axis measures the extent to which countries with different geopolitical outlooks, proxied by the difference in their voted patterns at the UN, and let's call that the need for diversion. Sorry, some of you probably can't see because the chairs are in front, but sorry about that. The y-axis measures the extent to which countries would struggle to find alternative markets for their exports in geopolitically more aligned countries, given the current structure of trade flows, and let's call that the impediment to trade diversion. And Australia is by some distance the biggest outlier on that chart in this sample, in part reflecting the well-known fact that over 80% of our iron ore exports are directed to China, and that China accounts for 3/4 of global iron ore imports. So on the face of it, that seems to suggest that Australia could find itself pretty seriously affected by a global trade war than some of those average exposure data suggests, if China is subject to disproportionately punitive tariffs and or the trend towards countries trading less with those they're most geopolitically distant from accelerates. But here too, we should be a bit careful not to jump to conclusions for 3 reasons. First, whether Australian producers actually need to find other markets is yet to be seen and will depend, amongst other things, on the specific details of any tariffs the US imposes on China, the response of Chinese exporters, the extent of any additional Chinese stimulus, and the degree to which that influences Australian exports and any exchange rate adjustments. It's dangerous to put too much weight on recent history, but during the US-China trade war of 2018-20, the dominant influence on our trade was not bilateral US-China tariffs, but the Chinese authorities' policy stimulus, which actually saw Australia's share of trade conducted with China rise. While there were important indirect adverse effects from tariffs on Australia during that period, they paled into comparison with those felt by other countries. Second, if Australian producers do find themselves having to divert some of their output to other markets, they're likely to find more opportunities than this graph suggests. And that's because the data underpinning this chart assume that the current set of prices, exchange rates, geographical production capacities, and trade policies are in place, whereas in practice, those would, of course, adjust. When China imposed restrictions on Australian exports in 2020, for example, exporters of barley, beef, and coal found alternative buyers for at least part of their output elsewhere in Asia and the Middle East within 6 to 12 months through a combination of market mechanisms and targeted government support. There are limits to this analogy, of course. Australian goods exports to China only fell 2% between 2019 and 2020, so a bigger or more sustained reduction could be harder to manage. And certainly, to state the obvious, no other country has sufficient steelmaking capacity to take anything like the whole of China's annual $134 billion iron ore purchases today. But a reduction of anything like that scale is unlikely, and Australia's relatively low production costs, of course, means we're not the marginal supplier. Demand may also be supported by relocation of Chinese production to Asia, Europe, or even the US itself, as Japanese car manufacturers did in the 80s. Over the longer term, persistently higher tariffs on some countries or products will be likely to incentivize Australian producers to adjust the shape of their production more radically, diversifying the range of products, employing more efficient, lower-cost technologies, and moving investment and output to lower tariff sectors. Adjustments of this kind, of course, are not straightforward. They're costly and time-consuming. But Australia has plentiful supplies of valuable minerals, traditional and renewable energy sources, high-quality human capital, and we've done it before. The country has undergone at least 3 tectonic shifts in its export markets since Federation, from the UK and Commonwealth trade bloc to Asia outside China, and then most recently to China itself. So what's this all mean for Australian activity and inflation? Another massive table. I may review my presentational tools in future, but I can't do that now. turning first to activity, this table summarises some of the considerations I've covered this evening. At one extreme, on the left-hand side, if tariffs were imposed clearly, predictably in countries to which we export little, directly or indirectly, coupled with appropriate adjustment in the exchange rate, material policy stimulus in affected countries, nimble rerouting of exports to affected countries' minimal financial market and capital flow contagion, the impact on Australian activity could be very modest. One could even envisage scenarios in which tariffs could increase activity for a time if they led to or were accompanied by substantial overseas policy stimulus, as I say happened in 2018. Of course, that's a lot of ifs. I had to take several breaths in that sentence, so it's not perhaps the most likely outcome this time around. Relax one or more of those assumptions, a more comprehensive set of tariffs, less overseas stimulus, a slower, more costly rerouting of trade flows, for example, and Australian activity clearly could take some hit. But the point I've tried to make today is that the far right of this table is a very extreme scenario. The system contains a mix of automatic and discretionary shock absorbers that lean against it. And consistent with that, one of the most comprehensive external assessments so far, completed by Ross McKibben and co-authors, which contains a number of those shock absorbers, estimates that global tariffs would subtract only 0 to 0.2 percentage points from the level of Australian GDP over the subsequent 2 years, depending on the precise scale and nature of tariffs. So what about inflation? Well, in countries imposing tariffs, the aggregate price level will typically rise, increasing measured inflation, at least for a time, as the intended higher price of imports works through that system. But that direct price level effect won't apply in countries that don't impose tariffs, and I'll assume for the purposes of this discussion that that includes Australia in not applying tariffs. But over time, tariffs, particularly if they're widespread, would impair the supply side of the world economy, disrupting global supply chains and reducing competition. And that effect, coupled with the potential for stronger overseas stimulus, greater pass-through of any exchange rate depreciation, will tend to push up on prices here too. And that's the scenario shown in the right-hand side. But working against that upward pressure will obviously be the downward effects of weaker demand that I discussed above, and the potential diversion of cheaper foreign goods to Australian markets that previously would have been sold somewhere else. So the impact on Australian inflation is ambiguous, in large part because it depends on a far wider set of considerations than the imposition of US tariffs alone. And given that uncertainty, it's important, we think, that you don't prejudge the implications of tariffs of policy, monitor developments closely, stand ready to respond appropriately as the facts emerge, and that's what we at the RBA will do, factoring that assessment into our overall policy judgments in the months ahead. So let me conclude. Is Scrooge's grim premonition of his own death is one of the bleakest moments in A Christmas Carol. One of the most joyous occurs earlier in the book when the ghost of Christmas past takes Scrooge to see how his old boss, Mr. Fezziwig, celebrates Christmas Eve. It's an exuberant extravaganza replete with food, wine, presents, singing, dancing and general high spirits, and this Dickens implies is a vision of what Scrooge could have been. No one could claim that Mr. Fezziwig's ball is an apt metaphor for the global trading system or Australia's part in it in 2025, but neither is the graveyard. The chances of being propelled into another global depression are low. Our direct exposure to US tariffs is likely to be small, with strong comparative advantages in raw materials and services that other countries need. We have a track record of nimbly reshaping our trading relationships, and our flexible exchange rate and independent monetary policy can serve as powerful shock absorbers. Australian inflation could move in either direction. So it would be unwise to prejudge what may happen in practice. As with every element of monetary policy setting, we'll be alert to developments and ready to respond in either direction with force if needed to deliver the mandate of low and stable inflation with sustained full employment. I wish you all a very happy festive season and look forward, Bessa, to our discussion this evening, which I'm sure won't actually cover tariffs or anything I've talked about at all. Perhaps I should just give my view on interest rates now and then I could go and sit down. But thank you very much.
Normally we go straight to the floor, but Andrew, you're a bit of a rock star. When we published that you were going to speak tonight, I received several texts from several economists really excited that you were going to talk. And so I thought instead of going straight to the floor, that I'd just start off with some light questions. And then the microphone on the right will be for media, and the microphone on the left will be for non-media. We will try to prioritise some of the non-media questions first. But I thought I'd just start off with the fact that you started in February, so you're almost coming up to your one-year anniversary. You're enjoying the sunshine. You get 8 hours of sunshine in Australia on average versus the frost in London. But what have been some of your highs and lows since you've started? And you know, they might be work highs and lows, or they might be personal highs and lows, whatever you want to throw in.
Some people in the audience are laughing already. I don't know why they think this is going to be a humorous response. Let me start with a serious point, because it is a serious point. It is a huge privilege to be here. It's actually very rare. I think someone's wrote a paper, actually. How many foreigners are asked to help set monetary policy in other countries? It's small. Obviously, I come from a country, the UK. I have Mark Carney as governor, and that was a big event there. I'm obviously not the boss in Australia, but nonetheless, it's a small number of people that are asked to come and do that. And I think you can only be very humble, genuinely, I mean this, about the responsibility that sort of gives you. I mean, it's exciting and great and stimulating as an economist, as a person, but it is very, very important, I think, you know, that you show clearly and actually believe that it's important to repay that trust, because policies, central banks always say it's unusually uncertain, it's unusually challenging, and perhaps, I don't know, now is more or less challenging than other times, but nonetheless, it is a challenging period to be setting policy, and it's very, very important that we do the best job we can, and, you know, I'm glad to be here doing that, but also, you know, recognise the importance of recognising that. In terms of sort of highs and lows, I'm going to cover the lows, but start with the RBA itself. Yeah, unbelievably impressive place. I'm sure there's plenty of ex-RBA staff in this room. In fact, I find almost everyone that writes notes on the Australian economy has had something to do with the RBA in the past. So people are outstanding. obviously, and I make this point, I assumed I'll be asked this, you know, what the hell have we got to learn from you coming from the UK with double-digit inflation and, you know, one crisis, omni-shambles is a word that's often used about the UK economy, and it's got some truth to it. I think actually what is interesting about coming from the UK to Australia is, you know, had the just an unbelievably strong run of macroeconomic success for so long that actually, you know, maybe one of the things I could bring is an understanding of how to think about when things don't always go quite right. UK has unfortunately had a great deal of experience of that. But the raw material at the RBA is outstanding. You know, sometimes we need to make sure that the sum of the parts is bigger than the individual contributions culturally and so on and so forth. There's some important work to be done there, and it's great to be part of that. In terms of the economy itself, look, I mean, I'm a bit of an economic nerd, as you probably told me, wading through the last 20 minutes, but I kind of, the opportunity to get to know a new economy in a new region. I mean, you know, you come from a services-dominated country off the edge of Europe, to an economy fundamentally different in nature and shape. We have a fantastic liaison program. You saw a picture of one of our people out there at the beginning, and I've been right around the country already and plan to do a great deal more of that, listening to economy, listening to firms, listening to people in the economy, because you really need to do that to set good monetary policy. I think you can't just sit there with a bunch of slide rules. It's been great to get to know people in the financial markets, and I want to do more of that next year as well. I've had a robust introduction to public life. That's why he was laughing there, I think, probably. And look, and in a sense, I come back to my first point. Monetary policy matters, right? It's a big deal for a society to delegate such an important task to a group of unelected officials, let alone people from overseas. And I think really important, believe it's important as a quid pro quo is to get out and explain yourself and to use straight language, to be honest and direct with people, and to value actually the exchange of views, even if they're provocative and difficult and challenging. It's not always going to be polite. People are sometimes going to have strong views. That's because it matters. And I think, you know, that element of being in public life, maybe it's a bit of an awakening, but it's not unexpected. The UK is a pretty robust place as well. So I've enjoyed taking the rough with the smooth in that respect. You mentioned the personal. I mean, I was here for 6 months on my own before my wife came out for me, because my children was just finishing at school before he went to university. So it has been exciting. I'm a massive, Sydney was one of my lists of places to live in. You know, it's one of the great cities, perhaps one of the greatest cities in the world. And the privilege of living here is just fantastic. So getting to know the history of it and enjoying everything here has been brilliant. Sorry, that's quite a serious answer to a light-hearted question. But occasionally, as at this point, I mean, meetings, at the end of it, someone will lean across to me and say, "It's all great, Andrew. What are you doing here?" And I've always wondered why people ask that question, because there's no... I mean, my answer would be, why would I not be here? Yeah. You know, personal, professional development, the opportunity to contribute to the economy here, the opportunity to understand and learn about the place and have a fantastic personal experience. It's all upside for me, and I hope that I can repay that a little bit.
Thank you. Thank you for focusing on humility as well earlier on. And I really liked how you focused on the architecture of this building too and drew the history. I thought that was really interesting. And then also talking about the impact of trade tariffs.
I'm going to give a bit of a plug. Sorry to be nerdy, but the New South Wales Library has an unbelievable bit of the website. Actually, I nicked it there. I'm probably in trouble for copyright reasons. But they've overlaid all the old maps and photos of Sydney onto a kind of GPS grid. And you can look at any particular bit of Sydney over time by pulling this little lever up and down.
Oh, wow.
Unbelievable amount of data work that must have gone into that. Maybe Macrobomb was involved. There you go. There you got your.
Name. I was thinking when you said
other data providers are available.
Presentation. Macrobomb is quite good on that front. Before I go to the questions, though, what are your plans for Christmas? Have you got any plans for Christmas?
Well, look, I said that my family was on the other side of the world, and my wife has joined me now. My son's coming out for Christmas, so I may be the only bloke on a beach in a wool suit with one of those knotted handkerchiefs on my head. If I am, take pity on me. I'm still learning the cultural norms, but looking forward to Christmas here.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, oh, look, there's a line there. There you go.
Oh, all right, goodness me.
I cannot see who that
some
is.
Some of the scariest minds in economics here.
If you can announce your name and affiliation, please, and then we'll go to the left.
I'm James Bond. It's a true but horrible story. I'm not from MI6. I am from Citibank. You talked a lot about tariffs, but what about subsidies? I seem to remember when I was studying economics, subsidies aren't as bad as tariffs, but they're still pretty bad. We're paying a lot of subsidies in Australia to manufacturing. Are these a good idea? And would they have will they have an impact on inflation one way or the other?
If this is about made in Australia and so forth, I mean, I'm not sure I've got a great deal of value added to make on that point. Clearly, there are areas in any economy where you could imagine a world in which either financial markets were unable to assess the risks involved with a potentially highly innovative technology, that you might, the state might well want to say, well, look, do you know what? As a bridge to driving greater innovation and growth, we think there's a case for getting involved. There obviously can also be cases where promoting comparative advantage makes a great deal of sense. I mean, you know, there's obviously been a trend over time towards greater national policies of economic support, but I'm not sure I'm going to make specific comments about the Australian approach. That's a political matter.
Paul?
Thank you. Paul Bloxham, HSBC. Thanks for a great speech. I really enjoyed it. I think
half of it was from you, actually, wasn't it? I was playing back your... there you go.
Well, thank you very much.
Is it bonus round now or is it later?
So I really enjoyed that the way you took the problem and looked at the and gave us a lot of different views on how it would fit together. And obviously the great uncertainty that's going to come about if there are tariff announcements. And so I want to game out a very brief story, which is on the 20th of January, we get a US president, a new US president, and possibly he will deliver literally what he says he will deliver. And on that day, you'll get potentially large changes in trade policy. So your meeting, the next one, is the 17th and 18th of February, and you'll have possibly a very large shift in trade policy that's happened, but really no hard information about what it means. You won't have any data points. All you'll have is your scenario-based, model-based approach to what you do with your sets of forecasts, and you have to focus on those forecasts for setting policy. And I just wonder if it literally is the case that what is delivered is what said is going to be delivered, whether that's going to make you more inclined to do less.
Wow, it's a good question. One element of your story that I probably want to ask you to fill in, if you still have the microphone, you know, what's happening to financial markets? Because and I'm going to filibuster a bit while I think about the rest of the answer there. So, it's been striking, hasn't it, that financial markets? I think, I'd be interested in your view on the hypothesis about what the Mr. Market or Ms. Market, I should say, or Mr. and Ms. Market, you know, has actually concluded about, you know, this package because. On the face of it, it's a very optimistic story that the markets are telling at the moment about what the next couple of years look like, including for companies that have, you know, China right through their supply chain, including for interest rates, including for credit products, including for equities. So it's interesting that, you know, maybe, and I guess you're part of those markets, Paul, to be honest, you know, maybe the market knows more than the commentariat about what is likely to come. Maybe there is a huge amount of innovation and growth to be, and if you talk to a lot of, as you all know, if you talk to a lot of companies, they are guardedly optimistic about the next period of time. So, you know, in part, one thing I'm assuming in your story, if you buy my story about what financial markets are currently assuming, is there'd be a sharp repricing in financial markets. Is that right in your scenario?
I love that you've swung my question back to me.
Very clever.
I didn't get where I am today, Paul.
The first time I've had that at one of these calls. And I think you're right, but I guess the question is, the market has responded in the short run, but, you know, we've been through this before, where markets can move in certain ways. The markets were pricing the European financial crisis before it as though it wasn't going to happen. Now, this is... So the key question is, on the event, if you get the event, and you've got a market response, clearly, but you haven't got clarity about what's going to happen over the medium term, how do you think about your forecasting framework? And you've set it out. I mean, you've set out what the sorts of things you do, but then how do you factor it in if you don't know the inflation story because you've got two-sided risks around it?
So... I was at the Bank of England after the Brexit vote, and those of you who are following it will know that the Brexit vote, the outcome was a surprise. It perhaps was not quite a perfect analogy for your description of immediate immiserating policies, although you could debate that. And the very first thought, of course, in that situation for a central bank, and let me assume financial markets are in free fall, because I think in your scenario, on the assumption they hadn't been announcing these policy change in advance, they would be. The very first thought is financial stability, actually, rather than monetary stability. The first thing to do would be to ensure there's sufficient liquidity in the markets of everyone that's involved here, to ensure that it is clear to people that we're focused on our stability mandate. In the UK, shortly following the Brexit vote, the central bank did ease policy a little bit. I mean, it was already quite easy at the time, but it did ease policy a bit. But what I would say, and what was quite interesting about that, is I think people's assumptions about the balance between supply and demand of Brexit evolved very, very dramatically over that early period. And had we jumped to a premature conclusion about the implications of it before we worked through the economics, we would have made a bad, you know, policy error. So I think you have to be focused on the instability implications of it straight away. You have to recognize that there'll be uncertainty, and uncertainty itself, of course, has a substantial negative macroeconomic impact. And then you have to do the best job you can in terms of understanding its implications for interest rates. That's only a beta minus answer to your alpha question, but well done. And we'll take that one away. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. I might actually go over to James Glynn, because he has been waiting patiently, and I'll come back to.
Thank you, Andrew. James Glynn from the Wall Street Journal. Yesterday, the bank gave us a substantially different statement than we've been used to for the over the year. I'm wondering, can you tell us, does the RBA now have an explicit easing bias? And does the RBA board have to wait until it sees the whites of the eyes of 2.5% in the target band before it will cut?
So I dispute slightly that it was a dramatically different statement, and here's why. We, and I'm pretty sure pretty much everyone in this room, have been expecting activity to slow. And we have been expecting inflationary pressures more generally to fall back. And indeed, that is part of the adjustment process that we needed to see in order to ensure that we were confident, and that was our term, sufficiently confident that inflation will persistently be moving back towards target. Now, we've seen that data progressively over time, and so even if there had been no news in the latest set of data, we would still at around this period have been starting to talk about getting more confident in our projection. And I remember, obviously, I remind people in the room that the projection was for trim mean inflation only to come very gradually back to the midpoint of the target over quite an extended period. So even relatively small uncertainties about the likely outcome of that could cause the, you know, terminal date at which we hit that target to move, you know, to a place where, as I think the minutes had said previously, the committee had a pretty low tolerance for. So, you know, that sensitivity of the projection to data was always quite large, and we were always expecting to get information in that would give us greater or lesser confidence about that, and indeed we've been getting that. So I can't prove to you that we would have written, you know, something similar to this in the absence of the most recent data, but I would suggest to you that that's what we would have been doing. Obviously, in the most recent period, we've had the national accounts, and any of you that have crunched through the farm non-farm split today, we'll see that there is a bit more news actually in that split from that split about you know, probably underlying activity than perhaps we previously thought. We'd had some weaker wage data at the margin, rents and house price inflation as well are coming just a little bit weaker, although inflation was overall in target. And so I can only quote the statement in front of me because I knew someone would be asking this, the board is gaining some confidence that inflationary pressures are declining in line with those forecasts, but risks remain. You know, and the biggest risk, of course, and again, I'm only saying what the statement says, is that underlying inflation, as it is today, remains too high. And so I think, I think, in some sense, and again, people in the room say, I'm only telling you what you know, the fact that this was, as I think Michelle said yesterday, an evolution of our position, you saw that in the way the markets reacted as well. I think, you know, February went from, what, 50-50 to two-thirds, one-third or something. I'd call that an evolutionary adjustment. There's a lot of data left to come through the pipe between now and February, and those data need to continue to come in line with our forecasts before the time we get to the February meeting. So, look, I don't think it was, certainly wasn't intended to be, and I think Michelle underscored very clearly at the press conference that this was a deliberate set of decisions and communication decisions made by the board, building on what we probably would have expected to be saying anyway, and recognising that the margins, some of the data have been a bit weaker.
And just in terms of the whites of the eyes?
Say again?
Do you have to get close to 2.5 before you'll start cutting? Or is there scope to do it significantly earlier than that?
Well, remember that what we're trying to do is target the outlook for inflation. And our forecast, and I think most of people's in the room, is for inflation only to come very gradually back to target. And it's that very gradual path that I think is part of the challenge with setting policy. You're not targeting inflation today, you're targeting inflation a couple of years out. And that, you know, to use a phrase, bloody difficult. And so you're forming views about that outlook the whole time. Is there a trigger level for the current level of inflation that would give us confidence that that outlook for inflation, is sufficiently strong to move policy? Now, I don't think there is a single trigger figure, because we're trying to form a view about the whole economy, inflationary pressures as a whole. Actual inflation is part of that story, but it's only part of that story.
Thank you. Merry Christmas, too.
Thanks.
Over to Ben.
Ben Jarman from JP Morgan. Thank you very much for your speech. The general thrust seems to be that, you know, all the details will matter with respect to trade policy. You've got growth outcomes, inflation outcomes, what happens with exchange rates. So in that context, when you're facing potential tariff shocks and trade shocks, is there an even stronger argument for monetary policy and fiscal policy to be kind of closely coordinated domestically here in Australia?
So years ago, I think I said this to John Kehoe, actually, and Mark Carney, the other foreigner in my life, said to me, when I was something ago, he said, Hauser, stay in your lane. And that was how he talked. No first names around there. And I do think it's quite important, actually. It goes back to the point I made, Bessa, to your question. Central bankers have been given an enormous responsibility. They're not elected by the public, can't be elected out by the public. We're given a mandate to deliver. And woe betide a central banker that starts to decide that he or she has, nailed that and is, being mandated, which they have not been, to do policy other than the policy they've been asked to do. And I'm quite often struck that when people, occasionally say, oh, well, wouldn't it be good if you were given fiscal policy or something? I think, do you really think that? Do you really think that, if we were to, be given a completely free hand, technocratic hand to set policy, fiscal policy, however we wanted it to be, that would be a sensible structure? And I am personally, doubtful of that. Now, an implication of that is that fiscal policy and monetary policy will be made in knowledge of each other, but separately. And that's the model we have. I am a believer in it, actually. I'm sure that you can write models down where, some Platonic philosopher king who had only the best interests of the future generations of society set perfect settings of monetary and perfect settings of financial fiscal policy. I mean, I don't need to tell you that's not the world we actually live in. And I think it's probably important that when it comes to setting fiscal policy, which is about winners and losers, distributional outcomes, that the people that set that policy are subject to public scrutiny, and I think a consequence of that is that we speak a lot, we communicate a lot, we have the Treasury Secretary on our board, and obviously people speak, the Treasury and the RBA speak a great deal, but in the end of the day, the people responsible for those two sets of policies are separate, and I'm not sure the allegedly bad outcomes from that model are quite as bad as people sometimes say, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Thank you.
Tapas.
Thank you. Tapas Strickland from National Australia Bank. I wanted to bring us back to the ghost of Christmas present. And
You're not going to be asked about your survey, are you? Other business surveys are also available.
My Google Gemini AI chatbot helped me recall what Christmas Carol, the ghost of Christmas present, does. And the ghost of Christmas present also reveals the symbolic figures of ignorance and want. And I was just wondering, yesterday the RBA board statement mentioned how they were becoming incrementally more confident on inflation data via income and consumption from the GDP figures. But less clear from that statement was whether they're becoming more confident on the potential of productivity to hamper or not hamper the sustained return of inflation to target, specifically if firms and workers didn't realise they were going into a lower productivity environment. So I was just wondering whether you could give us a little bit more updated thoughts on feelings about productivity and how that's feeling into the confidence of inflation returning to target.
Well, I mean, you know, as Michelle often says, we're not productivity experts. We have a commission for that, as you know. The RBA projection, and I suspect yours too, assumes some pickup in productivity over the forecast period, and that's important in as part of the story of bringing, James's question earlier, bringing inflation back to target. If that pickup doesn't occur, then other things in the economy would have to adjust, which might include inflation or might include wages or something else, and we'd have to keep a close eye on that. So I was trying to track back to the beginning. You had a lot of thoughts in there, ChatGPT, and the ghost of, did you catch some of the other points? But it's a bit hard to hear about that from the back here. But what was your question about productivity exactly?
Oh, my question was, is the RBA becoming more confident? Because in the RBA board statement, it was, we're becoming more confident about the trajectory for inflation, but that was more based on Q3 consumption and wages.
Yeah, I mean, can I reframe your question? Is in our overarching point that we're becoming more confident about inflationary pressures, does that include becoming more confident that productivity is going to rebound? Is that
Either productivity rebounding or more confident that firms and households are making adjustment to the potential for productivity not lifting?
I don't think a change in our view about confidence or otherwise on productivity was a key part of our decision in the month. No, I mean, perhaps you'd be a bit surprised if it was, because, you know, productivity data only come around every now and then. It's interesting, our board, you know, as you know, is a slightly broader board than the board I'm used to in the UK, and we have quite a few business people around the table, and they, actually, interestingly, when we present the latest set of productivity numbers to them, they very often sort of screw their face up and say they don't recognise them. Now, obviously, there's a, you know, composition point, but they point out that in many of the companies they're involved with, there's a great deal of investment going on in new technology and in ways of using labour more efficiently and so on and so forth. And I think that's quite a common theme, actually, when we go around in our liaison meetings, that this definitely is investment going on to improve productivity. After all, there's so many new workers in Australia. You know, there must surely be capital provided for these extra workers to work with, and over time that should become a more positive story. The data, you know, I mean, they have been pretty bleak, right? And it's not just true in Australia, it's true in my own country, the UK, and everywhere practically except the US. And so looking backwards, the outturns have been quite concerning. What we hear on the ground is that it remains more likely than not that the type of pickup we're expecting, it needs to come. But if it doesn't come, something else in the economy will have to adjust to bring inflation back to target.
Yeah. Thank you.
Andrew, how are you going? Because I was going to go to Joe, and then finish with the right, or is that too
much?
Yeah,
no, it's all
That's
right.
That's fine. Well, we'll take the question from Joe.
She's always going to ask me a hard question, so maybe
It was really good to see Joe on Q&A recently.
Yeah,
as well.
Excellent. Let's give her a round of applause. At least half the room clapped, Joe. So there you go.
I'm just trying to add a bit of diversity to the people asking questions tonight.
I know.
So would encourage the females in the room to stand up. Thanks for your great speech. I wanted to circle back, actually, on the shock that could be coming from China. And as you said, we don't know what the detail of the tariff policy looks like yet, but we're incredibly exposed. And you made the point, clearly, correctly, that when we look historically, Australia as a low-cost producer of iron ore in particular, but actually broadly of commodities, we tend to be able to ship whatever we can dig out of the ground.
Yeah.
So the volume impact is generally quite limited, and we saw that with the coal ban in China a few years ago. As economists, we often think about GDP expenditure, like GDPE, right? But in a small open economy, very commodity-based, the income side is really important. And whilst we might be able to ship lots of volume, we often take a hit through commodity prices and the terms of trade. And the starting point of that potential shock coming from China is one where a broad-based private sector income recession in Australia. Mining profits are contracting annually, non-mining profits are contracting, household disposable income was disappointing, and the terms of trade are falling. So Are you more worried about the income side, and how are you thinking about that as you factor in the scenarios that you talked about?
I think it's a good point, to be honest. I think you've answered your own you've answered your own question. You're obviously a pro. It's interesting. The iron ore price has behaved interestingly, hasn't it? Maybe if you get Paul back up and tell us how your forecast is doing. Do you have to put actual money on your forecast or just write them down? I don't know. But, I mean, the iron ore price has not fallen as much as you know, some of the more doom-laden scenarios might have suggested. Is that, again, part of this broader optimistic story of financial markets and it's all going to go south? Or is it telling you something that people know? It's interesting, right, looking at the market for steel, as I had to, when we're talking about things I had to learn about, and how that market is evolving. It's clearly, the use of steel in construction and home building and so forth in China, peaked some time ago, right? I don't need to tell you this. I'm probably telling you about what I've read in your own pieces. But the diversification in the use of steel and the innovation in use of steel is an interesting story and is actually gathering a pace. And my understanding is that some of the forecasts for the sort of peak steel or whatever and the sharp fallback in the outlook for steel production have been sort of somewhat falsified on the upside. So we have to be, probably humble about the way we forecast that. Look, I can't say very much more than the fact that the kind of scenario you describe is clearly a downside risk. It clearly is. And I think one of the interesting things about that BIS chart, one of the reasons why I showed it, is clearly there is a degree of concentration risk in what you might call Australia's current business model. And it's been enormously successful. A bit like you might be like saying, Apple, why are you focusing on the iPhone? I mean, wouldn't you too if you had such a successful product? But there are challenges there in terms of differentiation and of diversification in the years ahead. I'm not sure I've really answered your good question, Joe, but let me reflect on that. Thanks.
Thanks for your comments. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. We'll finish with the media questions. Because I have stretched the envelope a lot already, if
well,
we can just make the questions quite
succinct,
please. Yeah. So we'll go over to the first one.
Yeah, Sophia Rodriguez from Central Bank Intel. At a recent Q&A, you can hear me?
Yes, it's a bit echoey here. Maybe it's just me, but anyway, you keep going, Sophia, and I'll...
Okay, at a recent Q&A event, Governor, I think, leaked out a little secret, and I don't think everyone in the room heard that. You are a glass half-empty person, so I'm very interested to know the insights. What is a glass half-empty person thinking, especially because Bullock said that she believes that there are better times ahead. So
yeah.
Do you think there are not so better times ahead? And if you could describe that.
All right. Let me take the other two questions and I can pick and choose which one I answer.
Perfect.
So,
yeah.
Peter Hannam from The Guardian.
Hey, Pete.
And I was wondering whether if Dickens had named any central banker, he might have had a name like Hauser or Wowser. Anyway, that's not my question.
Yeah, that's true. He didn't like debt though, did he? He was
very, very
not keen on bankers, anyone in the room.
Yeah. So look, my question is coming from the Bank of England with a specialist monetary policy board. If one had been in place in this past year, do you think there would have been a different stance? For instance, we've had a year with no interest rate change. Would a monetary policy board, have lifted, been more active, such as in New Zealand, and cut?
Okay.
And instead of stasis?
Got it.
Thank you.
Last but not least.
Okay, so my question has two parts, Deputy Governor. So, firstly, in your... I'll be succinct, I promise. So,
you guys don't understand the game theory of this. If you offer two questions, we're going to go for the easy one, right? You should...
Oh, don't worry, they're fairly related, but I'll give it a shot. So, firstly, in your speech, you mentioned the impact of the upcoming, likely trade wars on the Australian economy is ambiguous. So, how worried are you about this uncertainty and ambiguity? And, with that in mind, it seems, the current Reserve Bank forecast for steadily falling inflation over the next year or two doesn't factor in these upcoming US tariffs and countries retaliating. So is there a chance these forecasts might be a little bit too optimistic as they stand?
Okay. All right. Very briefly. And I don't know. So it's true that Michelle has a cup that I think Phil gave her, which is glass half full. And I thought it would be rather amusing, although she didn't think it was as amusing as I did, to get a cup made which said glass half empty. The two go together, Sophia, as you say, so it's a perfect match.
It's funny, central bankers are trained to worry about the left-hand tail, right? They're trained to worry about the bad outcomes. And sometimes we do actually have to remind ourselves that monetary policy, unlike financial stability, is about hitting the midpoint. It's about making sure we get the balance right. And so if your question is, you know, what you're surely not asking me, what are some of the downside worries in the current economy? I mean, I could go on and list them all night. But there are, you know, countervailing upside risks as well. And, you know, we have very lively discussions, not just me and her, but the whole board, about that balance of risk. Interesting question, what would the Bank of England MPC have done in the circumstances? My guess is much the same, actually. Years ago, when Mervyn King, I think he said to me, look, you know, the system is... So has got so many checks and balances in it, you could probably run it with a set of dogs or something, and it would still come, on average, come out with the right answer. I'm not sure that was a cyclical low point of his confidence in the committee or something. All committees have strengths and weaknesses. One of the challenges with the Bank of England one is obviously there's independent named accountability, and you know, so everyone feels they need to get out. The world must know my view, and sometimes maybe the answer is, well, no, the world doesn't need to know your view. It needs to know what the committee as a whole is thinking. There's a lot of, because you have a lot of economists in the room, as you all know, you get a lot of technical debates sometimes which slightly miss the big picture. And so my suspicion is that, do you know what, and having sat on the, you know, not as a member of, but listened in to the Monetary Policy Committee discussion at the Bank of England for many years, that it wouldn't have been actually that different. One of the strengths of the board here is it does bring in people with judgment and knowledge, and to the question about uncertainty, your question actually I haven't answered yet, you know, actually what's interesting is the monetary policy decision is only about one variable. When you have, see policy, you know, business people, they have 28 decisions to make every meeting. We only have one. And so in some limited sense, actually, our decision making is a bit easier. In other ways, it's a bit more difficult. I think it's a great question, actually, about is it possible, let me reframe it slightly, is it possible that the biggest risk from all of this tariff stuff is not whether it's good or bad, but that nobody knows, and that uncertainty impedes investment, and it challenges our decisions about our household budgeting and, you know, job security and all those things. And it is certainly true that one of the biggest risks, actually it was one of the comments you got in the speech that I didn't probably take on probably when we were doing it in draft, is have you underplayed the fact that what if nobody knows from day to day, from week to week, from month to month, what's going to happen? I think that's quite a profound point and one that we will have to think about. I'm going to stop there.
Thank you so much for your generosity. When you said to me, you know, I'm happy to do longer in Q&A, you definitely have been incredibly generous. No, we've loved it. So big round of applause for Andrew, and thank you so much.